Well, howdy again, folks, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam. Right over there is Kyle, and we're going to have a little fun for y'all today. Going to have a little UFO chit-chat, and thanks everything. Hopefully, everybody enjoys it. We really enjoyed the heck out of doing it. Kyle, how has your whole week been, sir, with the weather getting nice?
Man, the weather's really getting nice. Yeah, it's been good, man. I'm looking forward to spring, so.
I know Punxsutawney Phil.
Is claiming 6 more weeks of winter, but I mean, it was cold a couple days ago, but it's getting nice now. So, I mean, it's been high 70s for the rest of the week.
There was a touch of baseball going on over here yesterday.
Yep. Well, the boys, spring season is just about to start. So practice begins in like 2 weeks. And they actually had tryouts yesterday. So,
yeah, I saw them all. They was all running around and baseballs flying and the whole deal. I was afraid to venture too close. I didn't want to get clipped. They've been known to bomb me with them. If I get too close, they want to drop Uncle Cam with a fastball to the rib cage if I'm not paying attention. Those boys, I'm ready to go watch them play a little ball. Hey, Philly, we were talking off air a little bit of stuff, and you were bringing up some strange thing you found in the news about some sort. Is it an invention or a list of inventions? What were you telling me?
Yeah, this is from one of our favorites, Ancient Origins. They have a new article on there that was posted by Tara McIsaac, and it's called The 6 Advanced Ancient Inventions Beyond Modern Understanding.
Okay.
Now, I'm not going to go through all 6 here, but I will pick out a few ones that I think are interesting. The article says, we've lost the secret to making some of history's most useful inventions. And for all of our ingenuity and discoveries, our ancestors of thousands of years ago are still able to baffle us with their ingenuity and discoveries. Now, the first one that they talk about is called Greek fire. Have you ever heard of this?
Yeah, it's part of Popiel's pocket fisherman, right?
This is like a...
No?
No. Greek fire. It reminds me of, what is that, Game of Thrones, when they had that battle.
So it's like napalm.
Yeah, kind of like that. It's a mysterious chemical weapon. It says the Byzantines of the 7th and 12th centuries hurled a mysterious substance at their enemies in naval battle. Now, this liquid shot through either tubes or siphons, burned in water, and could only be extinguished with vinegar, sand, or urine. We still don't know what this chemical weapon was, but it was known as Greek fire. Now, the Byzantines guarded this secret jealously. Ensuring only a select few knew the secret. And then eventually the knowledge was lost altogether. So they don't know what this mysterious substance was, but it's written about throughout history that they were using this in naval battles. So it's kind of like what you said. It seems like it's kind of like a napalm.
It's a type of napalm. Because I remember that the episode of Game of Thrones where they're using it. That's as far as we're going to go, folks. No crazy spoiler. But yeah, I remember where they're using that. But yeah, the urine, that's a funny thing. Is if that was a fact and you're hurling that at me, it would never burn me then. Yeah, I would be in pain. Could you imagine in a bat? No, thanks.
Right.
No thanks.
Here's another one. It's called flexible glass.
What? This was in the past.
Now, it says 3 ancient accounts of a substance known as vitrum flexile or flexible glass are not clear enough to determine that the substance actually existed. But the story of its invention was first told by Petronius, 63 AD. Now, he wrote about a glassmaker who presented the emperor Tiberius with a glass vessel. He asked the emperor to hand it back to him, at which point the glassmaker threw it to the floor. Now, it didn't break, it only dented it, and the glassmaker hammered it quickly back into shape. Now, fearing the devaluation of precious metals, Tiberius ordered the inventor beheaded.
Oh.
So that the secret of this flexible glass would die with him. Now, this story is told in other places, and there was another version a couple hundred years later by Dio Cassius, who he portrayed the glassmaker as like sort of a magician, and when his vessel was thrown to the floor, it broke, and the glassmaker quickly was able to fix it with his hands. So, they don't know what this was, but they do say that in 2012, a glass manufacturing company by the name of Corning introduced a flexible window glass, which is heat resistant and flexible enough to even be rolled up.
Ooh.
It has been used mostly to make solar panels. So even today, we're able to bend glass like that. So they're thinking that in ancient times, they somehow knew that technology too, but it was lost somewhere along the way.
It's like we talked about. They were a lot more advanced than what we give them credit for.
Exactly. Like I said, I'm not going to read the whole list. I got one more for you here. It's called the heat ray weapon. And you might have seen this.
I remember this.
That they even tried it on Mythbusters one time where they tried to recreate it. And, you know, what it is it's like a giant focusing mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And they would actually use it to, it was polished bronze shields. They would polish these bronze shields to where they could focus and redirect the sun's rays at enemy ships. And if they did it long enough, they could burn a hole in the ship, but more, it really hurt the people more than it did the ship. They said it would feel like your skin would light up to maybe 130 degrees Fahrenheit, which is enough to be painful.
They just raised the temperature on the ship, just shining it on them constantly.
Yeah, well, imagine imagine a ship coming in a naval battle into port or even another ship, and if you had 30 or 40 guys with these super polished bronze shields, imagine them turning inside out so it's, you know, concave instead of convex. Imagine those guys. I mean, you can't see nothing. They're blinding you. It's burning you.
It's hot.
Right? I mean, it's a pretty crazy invention. Anyways, I thought that was pretty cool. If you want to go see it, there'll be show notes down at the bottom of the page, and it's ancientorigins.com. So
that's pretty awesome. I got something that's not pretty awesome, and this just happened here recently, folks. We always talk about people losing things and, you know, in history, things being forgotten or thrown away. You know, we've discussed all kinds of stuff where people have uncovered certain things and then didn't want them to be found, so they were destroyed. Well, it seems like it goes on even today. I don't know if anybody saw this. This, I believe it was Live Science, but then it actually come from the Daily News Egypt is what it actually come from. But this is a thing. They actually found some new mummies in Egypt, but they were floating in the sewer system there.
Some floaters. They found some floaters.
Some floaters. Now, listen to this. Now, the remains of this, of course, what we know is what they consider the glorious era of Egypt and all that stuff, is still being uncovered. They're still finding these treasure troves of things and different stuff. That's what they kind of figured that happened. Now, the Minister of Antiquities said that they discovered several new mummies buried in tombs in a small village near Minya in Upper Egypt on a Saturday night. But the two discovered mummies go all the way back to Greco-Roman era at the time, okay?
Okay.
The problem is what they think ended up happening was that the sarcophagi that the police found the mummies in were floating in the sewer system, and the whole state of the mummies were horribly disintegrated now because they hit water.
Hmm. Yeah, you follow? Yeah, me? I'm with you. Well, how did they get into the sewer system, though?
Well, what they believe ends up happening is that these looters that go around, these I guess grave robbers and whatnot, because it's a big thing as far as the underground. As far as the black market for this stuff still, they believe that they were there. They were doing some digging on it, uncovered all this stuff, panicked because of it's a big, big trouble.
Yeah, it's crime, I'm sure.
Huge, yes. They panicked. They don't know if maybe the authorities were closing in or what they did, but they hucked them maybe into a big... But when we talk about sewage, we're not talking about going through like a wastewater line. We're talking like a big sewage canal, like a big canal. So they threw them into this canal, the whole thing, pretty much to dump the evidence. Like you're running from the cops and you sling a big bag of pot. They just slung a big bag of mummies and bones out in the middle of this, this sewer system.
I know what you're saying. It's crazy. I mean, I guess when I think of grave robbers, especially Egyptian grave robbers, I'm always thinking of things during the 19th century. It's hard for me to fathom that even today in 2015, there's still people digging up bodies looking for antiquities. I mean, I guess... why wouldn't they? Well, wouldn't they be? That's pretty interesting that there's still grave robbers stealing and trying to sell these Egyptian artifacts. Where they get dig in there and maybe find some earrings on a mummy or something.
Yeah.
And then go and sell it. That is pretty cool.
Well, and it goes back into us talking about, too. It's there is maybe a lot more still about Egypt that we don't know. They're still uncovering all this stuff over there like
there's
that.
Still so tunnels there's and chambers that they still haven't totally investigated. Underneath the Sphinx and other things like that, or they haven't come forward that they have.
Yeah. But,
and there's other tunnels, Collins Caves and things like that. I mean, there's just so many neat things that are still undiscovered. And we still do not know about the Great Pyramids and that whole area of the Giza Plateau.
I felt bad when you see it. That's just one of those little things I saw in the news. I'm like, ah, it's just like we talked about when they broke the beard off of King Tutankhamun's. I mean, it's one of those things you just hate to see that. You're like, I don't know. It's just a bad deal. But I got something else that comes from cryptozoology news that goes along with a river rut quick. And this actually happened in a woman from Hardin County down there. She claims that her grandparents saw a reptilian creature in the Sabine River while they were crossing it from Louisiana into Texas.
Really?
Yeah. Now listen to this. Now, her name's Carrie Celestlin. She's a 45-year-old Native American woman there. Now, apparently her grandparents have passed away, but they had told her this story. And it says that their names were Gus and Felinchi Celestlin. They were members of the Coushatta tribe of Louisiana. Anyway, I think that's what it is. I have no clue. But that they had moved to Texas because of a logging company had jobs for them down there. And then Camden, Texas, back in 1920. Well, they were actually moving in a buggy. They had a buggy with all their stuff in it being pulled by, she claims, a team of oxen. So, I mean, it was, this is old school.
Oh,
this
wow. Old school, I gotcha. Stuff.
Yeah.
It's not a U-Haul.
No. So this is all back in 1920. They're crossing all the thing. And they said the couple was reportedly traveling with 20 other additional families when they come across this bridge that they were going to cross over. Now, she says that Grandpa said it came up out of the water and the horses were scared of it. That I guess they had a bunch of, and they said the horses were, you know, of course, nickering and rearing up and going crazy when they saw this. Her grandfather described it to her as a monster. It said that it had a head like a dragon.
Oh, so this is like a plesiosaur or something, right?
Well, it got me to thinking.
Nessie, right?
Well, yeah, it got me to thinking, is that what it is? Or maybe, or she says it came up out of the water, but is also, could it have been a big gar? The Sabine River has a lot of large alligator gar in it.
And alligators.
Exactly. So could it have been something like that? I don't know. But also, too, I got to think, probably not, because you're talking about these people. I mean, if he worked for the pulpwood mills, he's been in the outdoors. This, you know, this old timer, he knows what he's looking at. He knows if it's a gar.
I agree.
Knows if it's an alligator. So if he claims that what he saw is that, you're like, ooh, I don't think that tricked him. There's nothing in that Sabine River that you're not going to see in the waters in Louisiana. But it's one of those things also, it kind of bums you out. It said that you get to thinking about it, too. The Sabine River was one of those ones that was actually, in 2010, got flooded with oil. That Eagle Atomy spill that happened down there. And they even mentioned it, too, in the article.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was 450,000 gallons of crude oil all in that area.
Right.
So it's like, if there was anything ancient living in that area, it probably did not buff out.
Man, that's terrible.
So it's just a neat account. I mean, I was like, man, that is... It's just a neat deal to think all the way back to the 20s and that they never really talked about it. I mean, because the article, the thing I didn't talk is she didn't learn about the incident until after the death of her grandparents. So it was like her mother and them told her about it, of what they said. So she never knew her grandma. So they didn't go around talking about, oh, I saw a sea creature.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't say anything like that. You know, it's just like, we saw something strange coming into Texas. We didn't know what this was.
That's pretty crazy. Yeah.
I love it, though, because, I don't know, that part of Texas is a really remote, you know, it's kind of... just thick and jungly looking. So I kind of like the idea of it.
That's pretty cool. Well, did you see this? You're going to like this. This is from Open Minds, and it's about a new UFO sighting that was that documents some UFOs that were seen off the coast of Florida just recently.
Really?
Here in January.
Awesome.
Now, you're going to like it because it has to do with one of your favorite people. Now, it's a group attending a contacting extraterrestrials using, get this, Cam, coherent thought and meditation practices.
Wait, before you go any further, can I guess on who this is involved with?
Sure, go ahead.
Dr. Stephen Greer.
Exactly.
Is it? Awesome.
Exactly. Now, they captured some dramatic lights over the ocean on the video. Now, you can see this video if you go to the show notes and click on it, or you can go over to openminds.com. You can see it. And look at this video. It looks pretty cool while I'm talking.
Yeah.
They believe that this event was an extraterrestrial contact and that other UFO researchers think the same, but then there's a small group that says, you know what, they think it's merely just flares. Now, according to the video's description, the sighting took place at Vero Beach in Florida just January 27th, 2015, so just a couple weeks ago. Now, this took place between 9:10 and 9:15 p.m. Now, in the video, like I was telling you, you can see several people that are present when one large bright orange light appears just below the clouds offshore. Now, soon after, a second object can be seen. And then a few minutes later, both lights kind of fade out. Now, the group had several cameras ready to film the UFOs if the chance to happen that they would spot some. And this group of people believes that they can call in. This is what you love about Dr. Stephen Greer.
Yes.
He believes he can call in extraterrestrial spacecraft using what they call CE5 protocol.
Look, folks, I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. I'm just saying if it was that easy, why not involve a whole lot of other people in video?
Well, you're right. Now his group, Dr. Stephen Greer's group, and that's who held this little get together. They're called the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or CSETI. Now, Stephen Greer, if you're not familiar with him, is a retired medical doctor who's gone on to just totally absorb himself in the UFOs.
He's the guy that found the little body.
Yes. What was the name of that movie that he just did? I can't remember.
I don't
offhand,
remember.
But yes, he just did a documentary.
Was it the Atacama? Whatever that little bit, what it was like an 8-inch.
It looks
long
like an extraterrestrial
thing.
Baby, yeah. That they claimed.
Yeah.
And right, that just came out. And I have not seen that documentary because you have to purchase it off of his website. And of course, there's no copies of it on YouTube or anything, none that I've seen. But anyways, when they had this group, they held what they called an ambassador training. Now, you've heard of this before. This is what they call it, ambassador training. And several times a year, they have this throughout the country. And Dr. Greer himself will provide in-depth training in meditation and remote viewing and will explain how the science of consciousness and ET communication, travel, and even manufacturing are connected. Now, basically, that sounds like a bunch of mumbo jumbo. If you pay Dr. Greer, you can join this group, and he'll give you ambassador training. And the training lasts 1 week. And you know this, it costs $2,500 for the week. And it doesn't include your hotel or anything. Remember, we joked about this.
Yeah.
And he was even on, he was on the Joe Rogan show, actually.
Yeah.
And you can sign up and do this. And apparently, he can take you out to the desert or the mountains, or in this case, it was Florida on the beach. He takes a small group of these people out. He teaches you how to use remote viewing and meditation. He claims that he can sit there and with a few minutes of everybody meditating and projecting these thoughts that the UFOs will start arriving. And that's what he claims that this is. And there's actually a video of this happening now. And you can go see it. Now, Greer himself, when the UFOs are spotted on this film, you can hear the excitement in the participants that are there. And you can hear Greer telling everybody, thank the aliens for coming. You know, and, you know, you connect with your palms out like this and use your third eye and use your heart, making a tetrahedron radiating our pureness and love towards the aliens. You can hear all this. Listen to this.
What is that orange object? Look up.
Oh, whoa.
Oh, my God.
Whoa, filming. Just don't pop too
up,
much.
Please crouch down and look because you'll block our cameras.
Wow.
Those behind me may move and stand up because... Okay, that, you see that color?
Yeah. That's not a plane.
No, no. Oh, no.
That's not a boat. No, that's a ship.
So let's thank them for coming.
Wow, and it's above the sea level.
Please turn off your night scope, Charles.
Oh, whoa.
Oh, here they come. There are two.
Whoever's right in the front, if you can kind of just stay low, because your head is right.
You can get on your knees in front of Richie. Look at this, how gorgeous.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so I'm looking with the night scopes. There's no smoke. There's no trails. These are not flares. And...
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, let's welcome them here.
Oh, they're so beautiful.
They're waiting for us to arrive.
Whoa.
Please photograph.
Yeah,
all cameras should be filming. So connect to them in your consciousness and invite them here. These are the golden ones I talked about. See how gold?
Yeah.
Because the horizon is only 7 to 10 miles depending on the conditions. So it's probably a couple miles. Everybody see them?
Yeah. They're so beautiful.
Let's welcome their beings on board to join us in meditation. That is such a beautiful color. So you'll never forget that color. Yeah, this is a major event. So we are grateful. So open your heart chakra and send them the beauty of humanity. And if you can see what I'm doing, you connect with your palms out like this and your third eye and your heart, making like a tetrahedron radiating our pureness and love towards them.
I love how he instructs the group to open your heart chakra and send them the beauty of humanity.
Look, this is one of those things I think you got to be involved in it to really appreciate it. I'm not saying it doesn't work.
I'm not either.
You know what I mean?
It seems like a bold claim.
Well, it's one of those things. Look, I know a lot of that energy stuff works.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it works. I don't know that it works in this case. I don't know. I've not been there. I would, man, if it wasn't so doggone expensive, I would do it. I would go and do it just because I want to see what's... I'll give myself into this. I want to see what's going on. I want to be part of this to see if it's a legit deal. You know what I mean?
Well, and I have to agree with the guy here in the article, Mark D'Antonio, who is a photo analyst for MUFON. He says this. He says, the facts are this. You see one appear in another way. They appear from the way you see them appear is from right to left. The way they go out is from right to left. The first one to light up being the first one to go out. Not only that, but you can actually see as you scrub through the video that they drift to the right and sink lower in the sky. It is at this point where the first flare that lit up then goes out as expected. This is absolutely consistent with aerial parachute flares. And I have to agree. It looks like flares.
So what do you think? He's paying somebody to drop them while he has people out there?
Why not? If you could get a group of 20 people to each pay $2,500, and then, I mean, how much would it be to rent an airplane and drop flares?
Yeah, I guess you're, I guess so. I mean, I guess that's, without going out, I mean, nobody's claiming that. Nobody's saying that's what he's doing.
Well,
I
he
mean,
says in the video, it was like you could hear in the video, he says there's no smoke, there's no observable parachutes, he's got some kind of infrared scope he's looking at. But of course, he's the one saying that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I still, there's, I'm not saying it's not real, but there is still, you know, a chance for fraud. Now, he claims that not only does he see these UFOs whenever he has these group meetings, but he's even seen actual extraterrestrial beings that have visited their groups while they're out doing these things. Now, what I do find funny is he says sometimes they're not there. This is what's so funny. Get this. He says that they have several visitations by extraterrestrials while they're in their meditation circle.
Okay.
However, humans cannot see them. He says sometimes they can, you can see the aliens' auras, but mostly you have to communicate them using field electronics. So again, he's saying that the extraterrestrials are there, but humans can't see them. So they have these gadgets, these electronic devices, and that proves that they're there, or you can feel their aura. So I don't know, man. A little, come on, be honest.
Man, I don't know. Yeah, look, I don't like that because it starts, I don't like anything that starts feeling like a scam right up front.
That's what it seems like,
and
right?
When you get into this kind of stuff, you want it to try to be, look, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, their own feelings. That's what this show is all about. But when you start talking about trying to take money from people and then scam them, everybody goes up in arms whenever it happens with Hank, the Bigfoot that wasn't real. You know, everybody gets
Rick
crazy.
Dyer.
Rick Dyer. Everybody gets crazy mad about that. But they're not crazy mad about this. You know, where's, you know what I'm saying? I don't understand the flip. I don't get it. I don't get why these, it's one of these deals and this is one of the, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that I don't understand. Of course, everybody knows there's a lot of stuff I don't understand, but this is really a confusing thing of what they're doing.
Yeah. I don't understand it. But speaking of the UFO subject, we're going to take a break here. And when we get back, we're going to stay on the subject of UFOs. Who do we got tonight, Cam?
We got Mr. Red Pill Junkie himself, folks. We got him to come on when he's not busy, of course, blogging for the Daily Grail or blogging for MU or blogging for Intrepid Mag or doing some interviews and doing some videos and stuff like that. We got him to sit down. We got him to talk with us. And we just got to pick his brain about some stuff. We just had a good talk about different things in the UFO field. And I mean, we had a great talk, and it was one of those deals. We cut it off and we did the show and all, and then we continued to talk after the show. I mean, it was one of those
three hours we spoke with him.
Yeah. We had a great time chatting with him. It was great fun. And I mean, his take on a lot of stuff is really interesting. It's just fun to get other people's opinions and other people's thoughts on what's going on.
And I've been wanting to talk to him for a while. I mean, I've spoken with him, off air, not on this show. I've been a guest on a panel with him on other shows. Mm-hmm. But I've never had him on this show, and it was really neat to talk to him. I love Red Pill. He's got such a vast wealth of knowledge and a good take on things. I mean,
yes,
you can bring up almost anything, even outside of ufology, and he's got some really valid points.
Yeah.
And so I had a great time with it. We're definitely going to have him on the show again. So let's take a break, and when we get back, you'll get to hear it. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
All right, folks, like I've always said, and I bring it in like this all the time with the treats that we try to bring all the listeners, we got a good treat on today's show. We got a good friend of ours and friend of the show and just an all-around great guy. Everybody knows him as, I guess, the Mad Luchador, if you bumped into him at Paradigm. But he is the king of the blogs, in my opinion, Mr. Red Pill Junkie. RPJ, how you doing, man?
¿Qué pasa, vatos?
Nada.
How you doing, guys? I mean, I'm so happy to be here. You know, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, me and Kyle, we've all talked several times, and we were like, oh, we're going to get him on, and then something always comes up, or me and Kyle forget because we're idiots or something, and we end up moving stuff around. So we're like, this time we're doing it, so we're going to get on here and do it right, and we'll get on here and talk a little ufology and have a little fun with that.
Yeah.
All righty.
Well, I was going to ask you about, and it's on our website now. If you go to the video section of our website, expandedperspectives.com, there's a video on there with RPJ.
And he's unmasked, folks.
He's unmasked. If you want to see him talking without the luchador mask.
It's like Kiss with no makeup.
No, actually, that is also a mask.
Oh, is that what? So it's like reptilian. It's like the old V movie. Underneath exactly. RPJ's face is a reptilian face.
Yeah.
Several I got you. Layers. All right. All right. I got you.
Yeah. And in this video, he's being interviewed on UFOHub.net. And he brings up some really good topics and ideas. And I wanted to talk him specifically about that tonight. In the video, you're speaking, RPJ, about how here in the United States, now I know you're in Mexico City, but in the mm-hmm. United States, it's like our government, you know, as far as being open about it, has quit conducted scientific research in the UFO field since the closing of Project Blue Book and when the Condon Report and all that, they finished it at the University of Colorado, I believe. But other countries, their governments are actively still researching this. You bring up the country of France, Chile, Peru, and I really think that's an interesting idea. And what do you know about the research of these other countries?
Well, first, we should get something right out of the bat, you know, by acknowledging that the Project Blue Book wasn't really an attempt to research the phenomenon, you know, the mm-hmm. UFO phenomenon, properly, you know.
Yes.
Basically, it was a PR stunt by the Air Force in order to calm, you know, learn to gather all the calls and all the messages from the public, you know, who were, you know, asking, you know, who were having these sightings, you know, things they couldn't explain, you know, and trying to come up with a reasonable solution, you know. And, you know, saying, oh, it was, you know, swamp gas, you know, it was, you know, you know, the planet Venus, you know, a flock of geese or whatever, you know. It wasn't really an attempt to actually gather meaningful data, you know, and trying to see what the phenomenon really was. You know, there's also a lot of speculation about how at the beginning of Project Blue Book, or maybe even before Project Blue Book, you know, I think Project Sign or Project Grudge, you know, there were some studies conducted by some Air Force officials who, after studying some of the initial sightings, you know, happening on the United States, you know, in the 1940s and 1950s, you know, came to the conclusion that the most likely explanation was the interplanetary origin of the UFOs. You know, and then, you know, some of the higher ups in the chain of the U.S. Air Force say, nope, you know, wrong answer, you know, go back to the drawing board, you know. And then, you know, by then, the U.S. Air Force was more of something like gathering information, but not really doing anything meaningful with information, which was something that Jacques Vallée, when he came and emigrated to the United States, you know, he really complained about it. You know, he had already started to study UFOs back when he was still in France. You know, he had already compiled with his wife a small data set that he tried to join with the U.S. Air Force data set. But you know, he quickly learned that the Americans weren't really interested in doing something meaningful with the phenomenon. Now, switching our focus to Latin America, we can see that in those countries, maybe there is less pressure, as it were, you know, from trying to maintain some kind of a status quo, you know, about, you know. After all, you know, the United States is the most powerful country in the world, you know, and to think that there is something that can fly with impunity over U.S. territory, you know, without the government being able to stop it, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's something preposterous, you know, it's something that will fly right in the face of the pride of the United States establishment. And maybe, you know, maybe with Latin American countries who don't have those delusions of grandeur, you know, thinking that there might be something, you know, outside of their control, you know, it's not so difficult to entertain. So what we do know is that in the 19 Latin America and especially South America has been always a hot spot of UFO activity. You know,
yes.
Countries like Argentina, Brazil, especially, well, my own country, Mexico, there were always been a lot of UFO sightings, you know, a lot of very active, what we call in flaps, you know, UFO flaps in the 50s, 60s, 70s. You know, there you can, if you can have access to old UFO books like the ones written by Jacques Vallée or John Keel, for example, I have here, right here, Operation Trojan Horse, where John talks about many of the sightings that were happening in Latin America and South America. You know, we have all heard about, you know, all those very interesting cases like truck drivers in Venezuela who were attacked by these hairy dwarfs, you know, that were coming outside of a flying saucer, you know, and when they were when they fought these dwarfs, you know, they seemed to not be made flesh and blood beings, you know, they were, you know, giving a punch and there was a metallic clank, you know, would sound.
Yeah.
Will be able to throw them, you know, several feet up in the air, you know. So maybe because of that, those countries were forced to try to really take seriously, you know, the matter. And right now we have nations like Chile, who have and Peru, like we said earlier, that do have an official department who take UFO sightings seriously. They do try to study them scientifically. How many people and resources they have at their disposal is something I really don't know. I mean, for example, back in the day, in the heyday of the Project Blue Book, you know, some people will say, you know, well, there are maybe there were dozens of, you know, U.S. Air Force, you know, agents, you know, or officers, you know, trying to study the UFOs. But no, the reality is that, you know, it was a very, very small office, you know, where maybe a handful of clerks, you know, and assistants, and that was it, you know. They were only, you know, filling cabinet drawers with written reports, and that's it. I don't know if the situation is different in Chile or Peru, but what I do know is that in that country, the giggle factor is considerably less than what we find in the United States. You know, we have all seen, you know, when some UFO sighting is reported in mainstream media, you know, what's the typical thing they do? You know, they put the goddamn X-Files music, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they switch to the correspondent, you know, and the video they recorded with the witnesses. And at the end, you know, the anchor man returns and he has some kind of quizzical look in his face and say, "Is the truth out there? Who knows? Back for more," you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're 100% right. They don't seem to approach it seriously. And I even remember when the huge UFO that supposedly was over Arizona, remember the mayor or the governor came out with the extraterrestrial and was making a joke about the whole thing. And then he later, some years later, when he retired or resigned, he came out and said, "No, I saw it, and you know, I really did see it."
Yes, that is, you know, like adding what is the phrase?
Insult to injury.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of those witnesses that he himself mocked.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
But when you see, you know, he is quote unquote justification for doing so. He said that he wanted to try to prevent, you know, a major panic from the people. That's what apparently these people, you know, they're still going from the idea that if the government acknowledged the truth, you know, it will be, you know, massive panic, you know, and people will be, you know, running on the streets, you know, and
yeah,
a major chaos because, oh my God, the aliens are coming from us. well, who knows, you know, but yeah, that was very, very interesting, and it's not the same in Latin America. I have seen, you know, reports, you know, from officers who say, okay, this happened, we don't know what it was, and that's where they leave it, you know. They don't minimize the affair. They also don't, you know, speculate beyond what happened, you know. They say, oh, well, obviously, you know, people who saw these weird lights, well, obviously those were, you know, spaceships from another planet, you know. They keep it, you know, very, very with the facts they have at hand, you know, and it probably is the right approach to do it.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another one of those things I was wanting to talk to you about, and we've even kind of discussed it a little off air, was it seems like in other countries, but Latin America especially, in South America, they seem like they're okay with saying, look, we don't know what it is. We're willing to look into it. We don't know what it is. Whereas our government here, it's almost like they can never say they don't know something. They can never admit to not understanding and knowing everything. Whereas down there, they're okay with saying, like, hey, we're going to look into it. We have no idea. And also, too, the sightings that we get from down there, I don't know why it makes it feel more credible. But when you get to the smaller villages where mm-hmm. there's not as maybe much as freedom of internet or freedom of information, and even some of the village elders, they don't get fame or fortune from these yeah. sightings. And then yeah. people go and talk to them, and they finally get to talk about their stories. It somehow, to me, and I'm there's no reason why, or I can't explain why, that it just makes me feel almost like there's more validity to a story when someone tells it after the coaxing of an individual, and there's no money, there's no fame, there's no fortune. It doesn't change their life in any way. They'll just be like, okay, I'll tell you what happened to me when I was a kid, or I'll tell you what happened to me when I was, you know, just right out of school or something like that. And this is what I saw, and this is what I felt, and that's it. And I've never really thought much else about it, or I've told a few people. There's somehow it adds more validity. And I guess I like the fact that it's more open-minded. We here in the States don't seem to understand that lots of times. It's that we look at it, like you said, they scoff and they mm-hmm. laugh. Whereas mm-hmm. I'm thankful that it's more open-minded. Is that part of a cultural thing that you think, or is it just, I don't know. Is it one of those things that because the government is so open-minded about it, that down there in South America, that maybe it's kind of trickled off to everybody else?
I don't know. Perhaps the open-mindedness from the governments comes from a deeper and more basic cultural aspect of it. It's difficult to say, you know. Well, maybe, you know, obviously in Latin America, the majority of the countries are Catholic. And obviously there was this, like, this clash of civilizations between, you know, the native inhabitants of this continent and the Spaniard conquistadors who forced their religious beliefs upon these people. And the people more or less adopted it with some tweaks, you know, creating a very interesting, you know, juxtaposition, you know, a very interesting merger. And maybe, I don't know, I'm speculating here, maybe that kind of merger is what built the openness to entertain the possibility of, you know, life on other planets if you go through with the ETH, extraterrestrial hypothesis, or, you know, the idea of things that we cannot explain. You know, here in Mexico, for example, it is a modern city, and at the same time it isn't. You know, you can go to some places here in the central area of the city where you can go to a marketplace that sells all sorts of magic items. You know, it's like you know, your own life version of the Diagon Alley, you know, in the Harry Potter things. You know, you can go and you can find a lot of curanderos, you know, healers and shamans, you know, and you can ask them to perform some kind of ceremony for you, and you can buy candles, and you can buy all things, you know, and you can buy all some things, and people are accustomed, for example, you know, in the Catholic nations, there is a tradition of preaching or asking to a saint for some favor, you know, so maybe that kind of magical thinking, let's put it that way, is what keeps you the openness to entertain all these kind of wacky ideas. You know, whereas in the United States, what I'm seeing right now, and especially after 9/11, you know, is just trying to force, you know, to eradicate all these kinds of non-rational thoughts. You know, now that there's this with Richard Dawkins and the new atheist, you know, the idea that, you know, all these things are not only, you know, stupid, they're also dangerous, you know, and there is this idea to try to eradicate them at all costs. And maybe even before that, you know, with Project Blue Book and all those, you know, we know that there was a fear from the status quo about these kind of narratives, you know, the tales of the contactees in the 1950s, mm-hmm. who claimed to be, you know, in contact with the quote-unquote space brothers, who were professing all sort of love and light things, you know, that, oh, peace on Earth and yada, yada, yada. And one of the things that the space brothers, you know, were very adamant about is, hey, you have to be, you know, you have to get rid of all your nuclear weapons, you know. And obviously, maybe in the United States, at the height of the Cold War, we'll say, hey, you know, that sounds like communist propaganda.
You're right.
Yeah. And maybe that's one of the things what the establishment to stamp out these kind of ideas, you know. And to be fair, on the other side of the Iron Curtain, things weren't that different, you know. Obviously, with the communist regime, you know, who were also very, very wary of anything that could, you know, challenge their authority, you know. Something like the contactees would have been immediately, you know, someone like George Adamski, if he had started to promulgate his ideas, you know, in Ukraine instead of, you know, in California, he would have been sent to a gulag in Siberia.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Well, I was going to ask you, there's one question that I wanted to ask you your opinion on, but I can't, now that you bring that up and what we were talking about, I can't really ask that one without bringing this one out first. Is in the video, and we discussed some of this too other times, is seems a lot of people have kind of changed their mind more and more, especially ufology investigators, that it may not be totally extraterrestrial, that there may be something more to it than what we think of as the little green men from space. Mm-hmm. And it may, you know, like we've talked about, it could be, you know, alternative universes. It could be, you know, like you've discussed, of human consciousness, and we've even talked about, or it could be simply us. It could be just all man-made. It could be things that's what we're doing with now. Can you kind of give your take on it, so that way I can kind of lead you into another question that I want to ask you?
Oh boy. Well,
that one wasn't so easy. I should have softballed it a little more. That one wasn't quite so easy. I'm sorry.
Okay, let me tackle it. So, like I said in that particular video, you know, I was born in 1973. In fact, I take pride on the fact that I was born during a year of a particular high level of UFO activity. You know, if you have read the books of John Keel and a lot, 1973 was a flap year, you know. So maybe that's why I'm interested in all this, because I'm still waiting for the fucking mothership to come back and get me home. But anyway, so I'm born in 73, you know, in 76, you know, Star Wars is aired, you know, after that, you know, Spielberg comes out with Close Encounters of the Third Kind, mm-hmm. and then in the 83 or 85, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. So, obviously, I was completely influenced by that kind of narrative, you know. I completely bought into it, the idea of, yes, of course, you know, there are people in other planets who are more advanced than us, and these people have managed to figure out how to visit us, you know, in some kind of spaceship, you know. So up until, you know, in 1991, when the big UFO flap in Mexico started, to be exact, it was July 11th, 1991, you know, the day of the big solar eclipse. That was, you know, the kind of narrative that I was searching for, you know. And this guy, Jaime Maussan, you know, who is right now the biggest ufologist in Mexico, you know, who he was the one who was more than willing to provide with that kind of narrative, you know. He will appear in TV shows, you know, showing off all kind of videos, you know, home videos that were sent to him by, you know, people in Mexico and other cities, you know. And that's what the guy was saying, you know, these obviously are spaceships, and that means, you know, that maybe, you know, contact with the extraterrestrial is close at hand, you know. And I totally believed it, you know. I even remembered how I went to this small UFO conference, and there was this guy who claimed to be a contactee, and he said, you know, I am allowed to say by the space people that there's going to be a massive sighting of UFOs on New Year's Eve of this year. You know, I think it was 1992 or whatever, you know. Uh-huh. And I say, oh, my God, you know, of course, you know. And what did I do? Obviously, I spent all New Year's Eve, you know, freezing my ass off on the terrace of the of my aunt's house, you know, when all my family had gathered to celebrate, you know, the new year. And I was, you know, on top, expecting, waiting to see, you know, the spaceship that will finally come. And obviously, I saw nothing. You know? So that kind of like started to me to question, you know, maybe these guys, maybe they weren't really in possession of the whole truth as I used to believe, you know. And then when many of the more popular contactees were starting also to be shown to be probably hoaxers, I'm talking here of Edward Billy Meyer, you know, we all saw when we were kids, you know, all these incredible images of his that he had taken, you know, in his home in Switzerland, you know, of the quote-unquote Pleiadian beam ships, you know, with the all the bucolic, you know, Swiss background, you know. Uh-huh. And I was totally fascinated by that, you know. But then when they were shown that, in all likelihood, you know, the guy forged all those photos using models or whatever, that's when I started to become more and more disenchanted with that. After I became disenchanted with Meyer, you know, that's when, by the time that Bob Lazar came into the UFO fray with his stories of reverse engineered saucers, you know, that were being worked on the S4 section of Area 51. Back in that day, you know, I was already in college, so and the internet was starting to become a thing, you know. So I will go to the computer lab on my university, you know, to sit up for hours, you know, reading all these, you know, forums and BBS sites, you know, trying to learn as much as I could about all those things. And also, let's not forget, that's when the X-Files, you know, also became very, very popular.
Oh, I still and love it.
Yeah, me too. You know, because they managed to capture the zeitgeist of the era. And the zeitgeist of the era is the government is lying to you, you know. Uh-huh. I still think, you know, that people haven't recovered from that, you know. That's why, you know, there's still so much distrust on official narratives and, well, not getting into that. So then when I started to get more involved in the online scene, when I found the Daily Grail and all that, that's when also I stumbled upon this little website by the name of UFO Mystic. And UFO Mystic was a place where Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop were blogging. And when I started to read, you know, the material of those guys, you know, my first reaction was complete and absolute rejection. You know, I thought these guys are absolute bananas. You know, what is this crap? What is this idea that UFOs could not be extraterrestrial, that there might be other explanations and whatever, you know? And that's, but then again, I started to pay more close attention and also to remember some of the things that Whitley Strieber speculated upon on his books, especially Communion and Transformation, you know. And little by little, you know, I was dragging and screaming. I was forced to reconsider my position and to acknowledge that, yes, you know, the UFO phenomenon is so big and so complex that the extraterrestrial hypothesis is just not big enough to include it all in all its weirdness, in its glorious capacity to challenge our understanding and our concept of reality. And actually, I think that's its biggest usefulness. You know, maybe that's the point. That the point of the UFO phenomenon is to challenge our question of our understanding of reality.
I think that's you laid it out perfectly. Is that right there? It's not big enough. Just that one explanation isn't big enough to encompass everything that's going on in this field. And that's what leads me to the question. I'm glad we got through that, because that's what leads me to this next is the differences that always struck me is in the shapes. The sightings of these crafts, the shapes have changed. And you would think if one's good enough, I mean, the shape of a car hasn't changed that much since the early 1900s, whenever they came out. The shape of a truck, the shape of a motorcycle, the lines and things have changed on most of these vehicles. But for all argument's sake, they really haven't changed that much at all. And you would think that if a cigar-shaped craft worked just fine to get from whatever planet it was at to here, they would continue to use this. But then they've seen saucers. Now they're seeing black triangles. I mean, what other kind of explanation, I mean, besides that, I guess, what's your opinion on those, these differences throughout the years of these changing in shapes?
Yeah, I mean, at first, you know, during the 50s, when Adamski was showing his pictures of the Venusian, you know, saucers and the motherships, you know, kind of makes sense, the idea that okay, so the cylindrical mothership is the one that is somehow, you know, traversing the great distances between the stars, you know, and is the one that contains all the other, you know, scout ships or whatever, and those scout ships are the ones that are coming to our planets. And I know that even some engineers in the United States, you know, they're starting to pay attention to the shape of the saucer and starting to study it from the aerodynamical point of view, and saying how, you know, maybe a saucer shape in a craft would make a lot of sense in way of, you know, having the least amount of resistance, you know, in the atmosphere and all that, you know. And maybe you will conclude, oh, so these craft have a saucer shape because somehow the saucer shape has some kind of utilitarian need, you know, or maybe in the way that they somehow manage to defy gravity, or maybe to harness electromagnetism or whatever, you know. And there is even a couple of interesting concepts of saucer-shaped jet-powered craft that the United States tried to study and to maybe to put into production. But, you know, there's also, you know, the Abro car that was built in Canada, you know. But the problem with all these craft were that the saucer shape is just way too unstable, you know. You will see all these things, you know, or just wobbling, you know, uncontrollably, you know. Mm-hmm. If they manage to lift just beyond, you know, 5 or 7 feet, you know, over the ground. And then, like you said, you know, there was also many other shapes reported all through the years. For example, there's the famous Socorro case with Greg Valdez. I think it was in 1964, the X-shaped craft. You know, and then after that, you know, let's go to 1981, you know, the famous Cash Landrum case, you know, of something that it was like diamond shape or something like more like a tapered cylinder or something. So you come to all these shapes, and then you say, oh, so obviously UFOs come with all different shapes and sizes. And if you're still clinging to the ETH, you will be then forced to conclude that there are thousands of civilizations that are just cramming up and deciding to visit our little planet all of a sudden, you know.
Yeah, they're like we're the Disney World.
Yeah, maybe, you know, like this is like the intergalactic version of some zoo. You know, say, oh, right. let's go see this the human before they blow themselves up.
You can't touch them and don't feed them.
Yeah, and there's even crazier shapes, you know. Like, for example, there are many reports of weird airplanes that will say, oh, well, airplanes are man-made, but these planes, they didn't conform to the natural laws of aerodynamics. These planes will be able to turn on a very, very small radius, you know, sometimes hover, you know. They will be completely silent sometimes, you know. They will fly at night, and the cockpit will be completely illuminated. And, you know, pilots who are hearing this will know that is not what you do when you are piloting at night. You know, you have right. You have the cockpit dimly lit in order to see, you know, what's, you know, outside. So, I was then forced to entertain other ideas that maybe these objects, they are some kind of projection, and these projections somehow conform to the observer expectation. And to that, in order to validate that, for example, we could turn back to the great airship sightings of 1897, you know. Mm-hmm. People were seeing in the sky some kind of weird dirigible, you know, with very potent, you know, projector light, you know, illuminating the night, you know. And then the people were seeing, oh, so that means that some inventor has managed to finally master, you know, or to create some kind of a machine and an engine powerful enough to lift the machine off the ground, you know. And that was the narrative back in those days. You could read the newspapers and say, oh, yeah. And even John Keel says that some people went and had press conferences and claimed to have built those airships themselves, you know. But then the airship sightings stopped, and then by then, the what people were seeing when strange airplanes, by the time that airplanes were already, you know, in the mindset of the people, and then in the 1940s, after the World War, you know, people in Scandinavia were seeing what they thought they were some kind of rockets that maybe they were being, they assumed they were being tested by the Soviets, you know, maybe using some kind of technology that they had retrieved from the Nazis after the World War, you know, and that's the famous ghost rockets, you know. And then maybe after the 1940s and then the 1950s, when people were starting to entertain the possibility that life could be in other planets, that's when people are starting to see the saucer-shaped craft. And it's interesting that in those days, you know, the saucers were many. Some of those saucers had rivets, you know, on their surfers, you know, because in those days, you know, the planes had rivets, you know. But, you know, now we wouldn't build planes with rivets, not even spaceships, you know. It would be ridiculous. But those objects that presumably came from other planets, you know, they had rivets. And now we're seeing, after that, they transform into something more sleek, you know, more chrome, with a very polished surface. And now I think that, but And after that, in the 70s and 80s, you know, the big boomerangs and that were seen, and the big triangles that were seen in New York and in Belgium, you know, started to appear. And now, in the United States, especially, you know, people are seeing the black triangles, you know, and they assume that those black triangles are some kind of special prototype, you know, create some black project, secret plane, you know, built by the United States, by the government. So maybe what we are seeing is some kind of phenomenon that is conforming to our expectations somehow. So in a way, what we are seeing is maybe a temporary physical projection or something that is inherently non-physical, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. You know, and you're right. It does seem like throughout time our version of the UFO has changed. And is this a progression that we're seeing of top secret military projects or these black projects? And that's what we're seeing. And that's why it transforms from a cigar to an egg shape, to a diamond shape, to a triangle shape. And maybe that's what it is. I mean, I know here when they released the budget, there are billions of dollars that are poured into these black projects and these dark projects. And people are theorizing that that's what we're seeing, that most of this stuff is the work of these dark projects, and they're building these and testing these, you know, experimental aircraft. And that's merely what we're seeing. Or, you know, is it different spacecraft that we're seeing, if they are spacecraft, because they're coming from different parts of the universe? I don't know. Now, I know that you're a big time and famous, world famous blogger, and you're really into this stuff. What to RPJ, what is your most compelling or interesting UFO case that you think you can put your finger on or sighting that is most compelling to you?
Oh boy.
If you have one.
No easy questions, brother.
I have I don't know if compelling is the right term, but I have a few favorite UFO cases, you know. The Belgian UFO flap of 1989, 1991 is very compelling to me, you know. Uh-huh. Many people saw this gigantic, ginormous triangular structures, you know, hovering over the Belgian geography, you know. Some of those witnesses were police officers, you know, and the Belgian government took this very seriously and sent on a couple of occasions, you know, F-14 or F-15 military jets, you know, in pursuit of these objects, and they never managed to keep up with them. You know, there is this very famous retired, I think he was a major or a colonel. He was one of the collaborators in Leslie Kean's book, the best-selling book, you know, UFOs, pilots, military is going to the record. I'm sure that you know the book I'm speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this guy, you know, has been very candid and very frank about it, you know, and say that the Belgian government directly went into contact with the American government and said, you know, are these objects that are seen on our airspace, you know, some kind of secret project of yours? And the U.S. government flat out denied it, you know. So and they even asked them, you know, to hand them more information about it. Some people would say, well, obviously the Americans were lying in order to protect some kind of very secret project of theirs. But the problem what I see with that is this. If they were testing some kind of very secret aerial platform that could hover over a city, you know, and then, you know, speed up at very important, at a very large speed, you know, and even outwin a jet fighter. The problem with testing that over populated areas is that, you know, the thing could fail. And if it fails, you know, then it could go and crash and create, you know, a major disaster. So either if that technology was being tested there, you know, they were very, very incompetent and very, it was a very risky endeavor. And but if the technology was mature enough that it didn't pose that risk, then that means that the Americans have had on their hands aerial technology that is, you know, decades of centuries ahead of what anybody else has. And if they have that, then why are they fighting their wars, you know, with conventional aircraft, you know?
Yeah, good point.
Why aren't they sailing one of those big-ass platforms over ISIL, you know, and bomb the shit out of those you know, on Syria? So, to me, that's what the idea of assuming those Belgian triangles was some kind of secret military craft doesn't make any sense.
And we've got plenty of places to test it over here. We wouldn't have to fly it over Belgium.
Exactly.
We got a lot. It's a very interesting thing. The shapes of the crafts are the things that always get me. It just makes me think constantly. It's like some of them, it almost seems like they progressed right along the side of our technology. As we started getting a little more technologically advanced, did the craft we're seeing started getting a little bit more advanced.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe when we start to dabble more in something like nanotechnology or something, maybe we'll start to see that the phenomenon is starting to morph, you know, and people will see something that would look like, you know, a cloud of nano machines, you know, in the air, changing shapes or whatever. Another one of my favorite cases I'm remembering is the one that happened in 1989 in Voronezh. That is a city in Russia, you know, still before the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know. And it was something so important, so big, that it was even, you know, picked up by the Mexican newspapers. You know, I remember reading it on the newspapers, how these school children saw, you know, on a park of this city, you know, a spherical craft, and here we come back, you know, to another shape, you know, in which this object manifests themselves, you know, a spherical craft, you know, landing on the park, and out of this object, you know, came like 7 or 8 foot tall giants.
You know, so you got out.
Yeah, that was me. But the problem is, these giants, they only have one eye. You know, they were like cyclops.
Or they were miners, and they just had a mining helmet on.
Maybe, you know, and the witnesses also reported some kind of weird, like, robot with lights, you know, in front on its chassis or chest or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And one of those giants, you know, he had his some kind of flashlight or something. And that is a very common theme in UFO reports, the idea that the ufonauts have this kind of like weapon that they use, you know, that it looks like a rod or a flashlight, and they will use it to immobilize, you know, the witness or something. And in this case, he used it. He pointed out to some of the children, one of the children disappeared, you know, and it was like, oh my God. And one of the things that I love the most about that particular case, which was investigated by Jacques Vallée, is that the children, when they drew, you know, on a paper for the researchers, you know, when they were gathering their testimony, the children drew that in the belts, in the buck belts of the giants, and also apparently in the hull of the craft, there was a symbol, you know, like some kind of insignia. And that insignia was the UMO insignia. The UMO insignia is a matter of some controversy because it was used in a case that happened in Spain in the 1960s And then after that, many letters were sent to some people that were allegedly sent by extraterrestrials who claimed to be from the planet Umo, right? And these guys who claimed to be like, they were like the typical Nordics, you know, they were like 5 to 6 foot tall, you know, blonde, and they came here in the 1950s, and they were benevolent, you know, they were only coming to explore us and whatever. And this symbol was like the symbol of their planet or their culture or whatever. And it was also seen like on the bottom of a white UFO in some black and white photos that have been also a matter of a large controversy. You know, many people say that the photos are hoaxed, and later it was learned that the letters were also a hoax. You know, they were sent by some guy who his intentions have never been clear. But the thing is, you know, the Umo case was largely regarded as a hoax. But here we have what looks like a very genuine case. And in the genuine case, we also have, you know, a symbol that is associated with the hoax. So here we have, once again, the self-negating nature of the phenomenon that has driven all the researchers mad for the past 60 years or so.
Right? That's one of those. It's almost like it's corroborating evidence that you see it there, and then you're talking about children drawing it, and you're like, why would a kid lie about that? I mean, I understand unless he was, you know, they were kind of pushed in that direction, but why would he lie about what? Especially if more, a bunch of them drew the same thing, it kind of starts adding up. Little things start getting crazy. Now, RPJ, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There we know. Kyle and I've been discussing this. We know there's something coming up down there in your neck of the woods that's going to be live streamed, that they're going to start letting out some photographs. Are you going to look at these photographs when they start releasing this? You going to watch this live stream of the Roswell alien?
I did buy a ticket to this
nice
quote-unquote historical event that will change the fate of humankind forever. I did buy, you know, a ticket. I said to myself, what the hell, you know, this is happening right in my backyard.
You kind of got to.
Exactly. I felt like I was forced, you know, like I needed to take one for the team, you know,
there
for
you
all
go.
Of you guys who will be unable to attend, you know, and I'm going to go, you know, not because I have any kind of big expectations that Jaime Maussan and all the other people of the quote unquote Roswell dream teams are going to show something that it will be truly groundbreaking. You know, I think it will not. But I will see it from, I'm interested in the event from a sociological point of view, you know, from seeing, you know, if it will really gather as much interest as these guys are intending to. And I'm not sure if it will, you know.
Just so the listeners know what we're talking about, there at the National Auditorium in Mexico City, on May 5th, they're going to be presenting some new Roswell slides that were discovered in an attic in a chest in a Texas home, an abandoned home, I guess. And you're going to get to, I mean, at least you're going to get to probably meet Dr. Edgar Mitchell and Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. And so, yeah, I mean, just for the listeners, I'm letting them know what we're talking about. It's going to be interesting. There's a couple slides of apparently that's been authenticated by expert scientists of some of the beings that were recovered, I guess, at the Roswell crash.
Well, the authenticity of the slides were that they know that they were photographs of, not of what's on the slide itself, but it's of the photograph, the material.
The Kodachrome.
Everything fits that exact time of when that was actually.
1947,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's what
allegedly. Allegedly, yeah. And the problem with that is that What I know about the Kodak and the way they register their products is that they repeat the number, you know, the serious number after several decades. So if they use the number 7, it could be from 1947, or it could also be from 1997.
Yeah, or 1977.
And the reason I know this is because all this has happened before, you know, in the UFO scene, you know. I'm here talking of the infamous alien autopsy video that was, you know, promoted by Ray Santilli, you know, in the 1990s, you know. And many people also vouched for its authenticity, you know, and many people were saying, oh my God, this is the real thing. And then what happened, you know, the guy came clean and said, you know what, this is a hoax, you know, sorry.
Yeah, right, yeah, super sorry.
You're going to have to be our infield correspondent when this is going down.
Oh, I will. You know, I also, I sent an email to Ben and Aaron, you know, and told, because they discussed this very thing on their last Mysterious Universe podcast. And I say, hey, man, you know, I'm going to go, you know, if you guys want me to be your little, you know, infield correspondent, you know, I will be more than happy to do so. And I'm also be happy to discuss whatever transpires on the National Auditorium with you guys.
Absolutely. We'll definitely have to have you on to tell us about that. Now, speaking of the bodies that were recovered at the Roswell crash, we had a listener send Cam a pretty interesting email a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, you're going to like this, RPJ. You're gonna get it loaded. Mm-hmm. This is pretty interesting. This listener of ours has a cousin, and this cousin of his owns a, I guess what you call it, it's a specialty animal food distribution center, basically, is what it is, to where, you know, they supply the food for a lot of exotic animal ranches and things like that. Now, not here in Texas, it's up north. And okay. He has this listener of ours, his cousin that owns that big thing, has a customer that buys, I guess, food for different animals and stuff that he had. But he also, back in the day, was supplied primates to the U.S. government for testing. And they got to talking about this whole thing, and this guy, this researcher that supplied these animals or whatnot, actually claimed that he didn't make any claims. He said he had a theory of what he thought the Roswell crash actually was. And this man, I'm assuming he's an older fella too, and maybe he's heard talks, you know, being involved in that. He actually believed that they were doing high altitude testing, that the U.S. government was, and they were using chimpanzees as the basically what's inside this little ship. And that they had, the idea was that they had shaved them down, maybe not whole completely, but, you know, the majority of their body had been shaved to apply all kinds of sensors. And that what had ended up happening was a depressurization of the cabin had caused the eyes to bug out, had caused maybe, you know, could cause possible, I guess, swelling in areas, who knows. Possibly also to the fact that some of the fire from when they crashed, when it burned back in, and that they were in small spacesuits, could have given the impression of them being small alien creatures.
Yeah, well, I have, in fact, read that kind of theory before, you know. It's not the first time that someone has suggested that the Roswell alien bodies were, in fact, some kind of primates, maybe a macaque or a chimpanzee, like your cousin is saying, you know. It's an interesting idea. There's also, you know, the idea put forward by our friend Nick Redfern in his book Body Snatchers in the Desert, that maybe those were, in fact, you know, POWs of Japanese descent, you know, and maybe or people who were used in horrendous, you know, human tests, you know, and after that, you know, after the tests were concluded, you know, they made sure to erase any trace of it, you know, because they knew there will be dire repercussions of it. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, these guys are going to show something that may or may not look biological, and even if it is biological, then what do you do with that? You know, getting back to Nick Redfern, you know, he wrote a very interesting post over a Mysterious Universe to say, you know, what make us think that these Roswell slides will not follow the same fate as the Patterson-Kimley film, you know? The Patterson-Kimley film is from 1967, you know, and after, I don't know, 50 years or so, there's still, you know, 50% of the cryptozoological camp are convinced that it's the real deal. You know, it's a non-human, unknown primate. You know, that the Patterson and Gimli, you know, filmed on, I think it's California. And the other 50%, along with the 100% of the skeptics, are convinced that it's just a guy with a gorilla suit, you know? Yeah. And the reason, because we are still fighting over a 50-year-old 8mm film, is because cryptozoologists have failed to provide a body in order to try to analyze and to compare it with the Patterson-Gimli film. And the same thing could happen to this, to Don Schmidt and Karen with that. Okay, so they will show the slides, and yes, you know, the thing would look like what we assume an alien should look like, you know, the typical stereotype of the small body, big head, big eyes, and whatever. But since we are still, you know, without an actual body of alien origin, you know, where do we proceed beyond that, you know? You know, we are in the 21st century. We are in 2015, you know. Photographical evidence is becoming meaningless by the minute, you know. The YouTube is filled with very interesting videos showing any kind of things that we know were made by some over-the-counter CGI software, you know. So even if these guys are straining to prove that the footage is from 1947 and it is not a CGI forgery, they will still be unable to show that the thing photographed is some kind of prop or mannequin. It could very well be some kind of something that was part of some kind of disinformation of PSYOPs campaign launched by the Air Force.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Man, cryptozoology, that's something we're going to have you on again sometime to talk about. Thanks again, Red Pill, for coming on. You are a deep well of knowledge when it comes to this stuff. People, you can find him. He writes for Mysterious Universe. You can find him on the Daily Grail. His Red Pills of the Week. Is there anywhere else, Red Pill, that they can find you?
I also contribute with the blog of Intrepid Magazine. I think it is new.intrepidmag.com or something like that. You know, it's a very complicated URL. Although I have to be honest, you know, I haven't written anything for them, you know, in the last 5 months or so. But you know, aside from that, you know, I'm also a semi-regular guest on the Grimerica show, you know.
That's
right.
I also
love to jump in with Darren and Graham and talk about anything under the sun.
Absolutely. Well, we'll put all those links and everything in the show notes. Thanks again for coming on. You take care.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I really enjoyed that interview with Red Pill. I like his take on things.
Yeah.
And I do like the fact that, you know, he's right. It's like the U.S. government doesn't really want to pay attention to the study of UFOs. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't, but openly they don't.
Yeah.
And these other countries, they receive it well, much better, I think. They're open to it. They're willing to publicly announce that they're looking into this and that, where it's like scoffed at here and laughed off, like we talked about. And I don't know why that is.
I feel like they're afraid that if they look into it, it's going to be adding validity to it.
It's like if they don't acknowledge it, doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Well, that is pretty cool. Now, did you see this concerning extraterrestrials? It seems like there was an unreported close encounter of the third kind case in New York State back in 1880.
Really?
Yeah. Now, this just came out. This comes from our friends over at Who Forted. This was posted by Ken Summers. And it talks about that in the 1880s, there was a close encounter of the third kind. And this is much before Roswell or any of the sci-fi hysteria about little green men or gray men or whatever. And this happened. Now, check this out. Now, passed down through the generations by their younger brother was an unusual family tale. The story is set in the remote hills near Cameron, New York, also known as Cameron Mills back then, in April of 1880. Two sisters, named Elizabeth and Eva, were on a long hike to their district's one-room schoolhouse one day, accompanied by a few other children. But as the group approached a small bridge crossing a small stream, they noticed something peculiar on the opposite side. Clustered from the bridge down the embankment to the creek was a small group of what they called little people. The beings motioned for the children to continue across the bridge, but their parents had cautioned them to be wary of strangers. So instead, the children ran home as fast as they could. Now, what was this? Goblins, leprechauns, evacuees from the Hopkinsville case?
Right, yeah.
You know, or were they extraterrestrials? Now, how the children described the being is very unusual. They were said to be small, skinny, and oddly colored in a grayish tone. They wore skin-tight, metallically shining clothing like lycra, and possessed abnormally long, spindly fingers. In short, they seem to echo the classic modern description of alien grays found in Roswell crash stories and the stories of Betty and Barney Hill. But this story happened so long ago, this, you know, predates Roswell and Betty and Barney Hill. So what is this? This seems to be perhaps the first actual account or description of a gray alien back in 1880. And, you know, it was never really talked about.
And then we had the... kind of the same thing when they talked about the Aurora crash. It was like in 1898, wasn't it?
I'm not sure the exact date of that, but I think you might be right. Yeah. So, I mean,
that's really strange.
I wonder though, is it actual? I mean, it sounds like an alien gray, but maybe it was a fae folk or something. They described them as little people.
Yeah.
I mean, and they did describe them with the spindly legs and stuff, but it doesn't really say that they described anything about large eyes or anything like that. I don't know.
Maybe they didn't get a good look at that. You know what I mean? Maybe they just kind of the outline, the size, things like that.
I thought it was a bizarre case.
That is very bizarre.
Right?
Oh, man. I don't know. I love it, though. That's just a cool old story, a cool old sighting. It's neat because it's a little bit of the UFO lore that is kind of unheard of. I wonder how many more stories are really out there like that we really haven't heard that are older accounts of it.
I think there's a lot of people that, for fear of ridicule and things like that, just do not come forward or speak about it. I'd be willing to bet there's a lot of cases of unusual sightings of not just UFOs, but of actual extraterrestrials or whatever these beings are that just people don't mention or don't want to bring up. So what's going on with you?
Well, not much. We've just been slaving away, making sure we're trying to get this out as best we can. So that's what we just keep doing. And it seems to be picking up. So, folks, we really appreciate all the support. Speaking of support, if you liked what Red Pill did, you want to follow him on Twitter. I forgot to. You can follow him on there. He posts a bunch of stuff. Like I said, you can go. I think it's I know what it is. That's Red_Pill_Junkie. Red Pill Junkie on Twitter. That's the place. You can also find him on the Daily Grail. He's also on the Grammarica show. He's on their podcast all the time. They have him on there discussing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stuff. You can read all of his blogs on Mysterious Universe's website. What is that? Mysteriousuniverse.org, I believe is what it is. You can find all of his stuff there. So if you enjoyed what he's got there, you can locate it. If you're going to be up at Paradigm, if you're planning on going this year, he'll be there. So I think he's there every year. I think he makes the trip up there to it.
And yeah,
he'll be easy to find, folks. Red Pill will be wearing a luchador mask, and he's legitly like 6'7". So he'll be real easy to spot. He'll be this giant Mexican wrestler is what you'll see.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, so he'll be fine to find. He'll be easy to find. So, yeah, everything. I mean, like I said before, I enjoy it. I really enjoyed talking to him, and hopefully we'll get to have him back on. Hopefully when he comes to the States one time, we'll get him to swing through Texas, and we'll just lock him down and throw him in studio in here for a little while.
That's right. And if you have any UFO sightings of your own and you would like to share them with the show, don't forget, email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call the phone number and leave us a voicemail describing the story. Yeah. Cam, what's the number?
Oh, now you're going to make me pick my brain again. 817-945-3828.
That's right. That's right. I was just checking you.
Yeah. I got too many numbers. I got too much stuff in my head. Look, I know I got a big head, but it doesn't hold as much as I need it to hold.
Oh, the passwords and stuff and the login information is mind-boggling. Well, I mean, literally, you have to have it for everything nowadays. Yeah. And I forget... you know, and then you got to update some, and then you got to have uppercase letters, lowercase letters, numbers, symbols. It can't be, it has to be at least 15 digits long. You know, it is mind numbing.
Yeah, I can't deal with it.
All the passwords have. But everybody have a good week. Don't work too hard. And for those elite members, we'll speak to you on Thursday.
Everybody take care. Peace.